Hi, and welcome to Awaken Your Inner Wisdom. I'm Cissy Williams, and in this interview, you'll meet the amazing Helena Montelius, who's a certified facilitator of the work of Byron Katie, as well as a meditation teacher. In this interview, Helena shares how we can uncover our true self through inquiry, so we can let go of the stories that hold us stuck to a limiting perception of ourselves and our lives, and instead come to real peace within ourselves. So let's head over to this interview now, where you'll meet the wonderful Helena Montelius. Hi, Helena. Thank you so much for being here today. It's always an honor to speak with you and that you're now here on our podcast. Thank you for coming.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
So we are going to be speaking about inquiry and how we can use inquiry to, you know, help us let go of our stories. So I would like to ask you, first of all, how did your journey into inquiry begin, and what is a story?
Okay, well, those are two big questions.
Yes. But,
yes. Well, I found Byron Katie's work in 2000, and I had been a seeker and a spiritual teacher myself for many years. So I just checked it out as something interesting. I was in a very happy place. I was pregnant with my second child. I was living with the love of my life, and well, the person I thought was the love of my life at that point, and my son. So I didn't really have a reason to use the method. And then 13 months later, my son overdosed and died. He overdosed on heroin and died. And I was in tremendous pain, obviously, tremendous yeah. grief. And a lot of stuff that I had been teaching myself, it just didn't feel valid anymore. It didn't really help me in that very raw, shocking situation. And so then I remembered, yeah, the work. Maybe I should try to do the work. So I started doing it on my own in that very, very dark place. And I was very fascinated by what a difference it made for my process in my grief. So the stories, which I'll explain later what we call a story, but the thoughts would come in, you know, it's my fault that he died. I should have known he was using drugs. I should have done something to help him. And that was such a painfully crushing, guilt-inducing thought. I would be on the floor in the bathroom throwing up with guilt. So inquiry came in, you know, and supported me in questioning, is that true that it's my fault that he's dead? And so slowly this heavy burden started lifting, and I would even question, my son is dead. Is that true? Because, and I found that he's alive in my heart because I've never stopped loving him. And now, 21 years later, that hasn't changed. He lives in my heart and he's alive there. And he's alive in my mind, in my memories of him. So that was a very intense start. But that's how I came to inquiry.
Yeah.
And I was in such a open state, as you are when someone you deeply, deeply love, just boom, their body is gone. So I could really notice the effect it had, I think, much more than I would have if I had been in a more normal state of mind, so to speak. So yeah, that was my deep dive into what this process can do, and the process called the work of Byron Katie. And I pretty much committed myself to that process right then and there, because I felt if I can work through the worst thing that happened to me in my entire life, it's still the worst thing that ever happened to me, and come to a place of gratitude, and come to a place of just, when I think of my son, I am just flooded with love, instead of being flooded with guilt that, you know, it was my fault and I should have known. And I didn't give him a good enough upbringing. That's why he ended up doing drugs, and that's why it's my fault. So that is what we call a story. Mm. Something happens in life, and I start making interpretations, meanings out of that event. So I create a story. And brain scientists say there's even a part of our brain which has that job to try to figure out what is going on here. They call it the spin doctor because we spin stories. We're trying to make meaning. Why did this happen? You know, who's to blame? Whose fault is it? That's another way we spin stories. So a story is a series of explanations and interpretations that I make out of something. And then I hold on to that.
The image I got just before you said spin doctor, actually, was the image of like a spider spinning a web of all these strands of stories and interpretations and perceptions and beliefs and all of that. So when you then start to disentangle yourself from this web, if it's then really big and sticky and hard that we're really stuck in it, I would imagine it takes a while. Like with the death of your son, I would imagine taking you a while to go through the inquiry of all these different strands so that you could be free from that.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I would say I pretty much worked with this for about 3 years.
Yeah.
Meditation and inquiry on a daily basis, just to, because I had a daughter too. I had a 13-month-old toddler. So I couldn't just break down and lay around and cry all day. I was busy with my little girl, and I'm so grateful that I was. But yes, a story is definitely a spider web of thoughts, one thought linking into the next, each thought proving that the other one is true. So yes, it takes a while with a big story like this. I'm a Sagittarius, so I go deep. I wanted to get to the bottom of all of this. So I questioned all of our cultural beliefs around death as well. You know, death is bad. Death is horrible. Death is painful. Grief is horrible. Grief is something you have to get over. You have to get over this and move on. And what I found through questioning these stories and thoughts was that grief was actually something beautiful. If I didn't judge it and hold on to a story that, you know, I need to get over this, grief was beautiful. It pulled me back into my heart every time it opened my heart. It was sort of like a labor, but a backwards labor to birth my son into another dimension. And if I didn't see it as a bad thing, it actually helped me heal.
And it also then birthed you into a new expression of you that is more true of who you truly are in that essence. Yes, it's like he was birthing you, you were birthing him, you were birthing you. And it's beautiful. I love that. I love that. Because I remember when I asked Byron Katie this, because she's amazing to interview, because you never know where she's going to go. It's like, I can't track her. I can track most other people. I just can't track her. It's like it's a really extraordinary experience. But I remember I asked her, you know, when you first had this insight with that she's not her story, how long did you then spend questioning your thoughts? And I think she said a couple of years, because I think often when we hear it, we go, oh great, I want that quick fix, you know, this sounds really great, I just go through these questions and then I'm done. And we forget that no, there is that whole web and there is work to show up for in that, and that, you know, it needs to take the time it takes.
Absolutely. And what I noticed with the work was it did give me peace in the moment as I was in this process. Beautiful. So I would work one thought and I would come to, you know, the last question, who would you be without this story? And I could always find that presence, that beingness that was right there. So the inquiry became a way to meditate and to come back to that source. So, and then later that day, maybe, boom, some memory would come from my son. Wow, you should have been there for him more when he was a kid. Okay, that's my next thought to work on. And I write that one down and take that through inquiry. But what I noticed was it was like it became lighter and lighter as I went along in my process.
Beautiful. So you were being given the medicine each time.
Yeah.
As you work through it. I love that. So it's then starting to, you see, in the Norse tradition, we have the spirit weavers, the Norns. Yeah, that are, you know, spinning the web of life. And when I work with shamanic stuff, I do find sometimes see these spiders that are spinning something that is quite toxic and people get kind of stuck in it. So whilst the spirit weavers, I see them as, you know, they're then spinning love, the medicine, they're something new into being. So have you found that you could use your spin doctor in a different way like that, so that you are more a choice?
Yeah, absolutely. Like one of the long-term side effects of this method is that it changes your relationship to mind. Yeah. It doesn't have that power over me anymore. And yes, mind becomes more attuned with reality, with what is. And as I found, and as I know you found too, what is a very beautiful universe. So yes, the spin doctor is much more supportive. The inner voice is supportive and kind towards myself and others. You know, if a friend doesn't show up for lunch, I don't go to the place of, oh, she doesn't care about me. And, oh, she forgot last lunch too. You know, I guess I'm not important to her. And, you know, I don't know. I think I need to set some more boundaries with this person or, you know, whatever, stuff like that. And now it's more, oh, she's not showing up. I guess something happened. I'm just going to, you know, read my book or whatever.
Beautiful. They should really teach this in schools before we hit puberty. When that, I see that certainly when my daughters were growing up, and especially with social media, it's like that spin doctor can run out of control.
Very much so. Yeah. And the teenage mind is very, it's black or white, it's love or hate, it's never or always. So yeah, it can be very intense. There are actually projects where they do teach this in school, the thinking project.
I think it's beautiful. So for someone who has never experienced the work, could you give an example of how you took yourself through that process with a thought?
Yes. The first step is to find out what is really bothering me in this situation. So we can take a little lighter example, not to do with my son's death. Let's say I'm sitting at lunch and my friend doesn't show up and I'm upset and I'm hurt. And so the first step is to figure out what is it that's really bothering me. It's not that she didn't show up. It's that I think she doesn't care about me. That's what's really hurting my feelings. So I write that down. She doesn't care about me. Is that true? Is the first question. And we often believe our thoughts unless we have been in this practice for a while. So we might say, yeah. Because if she cared, she would have remembered, she would have put it in her calendar, her phone, she would have been here, right? So the second question, I double check my interpretation of this event. She doesn't care about me. Can I absolutely know that's true? Are you absolutely sure this is why your friend isn't here for lunch? Are you absolutely sure she doesn't care about you? And you allow your mind to land on a yes or a no in the first and second question. So sometimes we're very convinced and we'll be like, yes. And other times, as we let the question drop in, can I absolutely know that she doesn't care about me? And if I'm really honest, I'm going to have to say no, because
I love that question.
Yeah.
Because once that question hits you, you go, well,
maybe not.
Maybe not. Yeah.
Yeah. Can I know what's going on in her mind? Can I know more than God? Can I say for all eternity of time that she does not care about me? So, no. So good. Then I take a look at how do I react? What happens when I'm believing this thought? I'm sad. I'm hurt. I'm upset. How do I treat my friend when I believe this thought? You know, mentally, I'm judging her. I'm closing my heart to her. What images do I see? I see all the times before she forgot something. She forgot my birthday a couple of years ago. You know, so I'm starting to build this case in my head against my friend. How does my body feel? Uptight, my shoulders went up, I'm not breathing. So the third question, how do I react? What happens when I believe this thought? It brings the awareness to all the ways this thought affects me. Mm. And then the fourth question is, who would you be without this thought? Who would I be right now sitting here in the restaurant, my friend didn't show up, without the story that she doesn't care about me? I notice I'm fine. I'm concerned about my friend. I wonder what happened. And I'm probably texting her by now, hey, how are you doing? And I can do that with an open heart, or I can do it with the sense of feeling hurt and upset about it. So question number four is noticing before the thought came in, she doesn't care about me. I was doing great. I was in peace. The thought entered, I'm upset. So in the work, you get to explore the chain of creation. I think, I feel, I act, and I have. So I have a thought that creates a corresponding emotion. From that emotion, I have a reaction, and that will create a result in my life. So if I text my friend when I'm upset, I might say something like, yeah, of course you forgot the lunch again, or, you know, what's up? What's going on? Why aren't you here? We had a lunch at one, you know, and that might create a response on her end, you know, where she's upset. So I'm creating drama when I'm believing my thoughts, basically. And so then the last step is the famous turnarounds. So you turn the thought around to the opposite. My friend does care about me. How could that be as true or truer? And so then you sit in that turnaround and you find examples of how the opposite is just as true. Well, she agreed to have lunch with me. If she didn't give a fuck about me, well, she wouldn't have made plans with me. So you find some grounded, authentic examples. I don't care about my friend. So whatever you're projecting out on the other, you're bringing that back home. And yeah, in this moment, I don't care about her. I'm just upset for me. I'm just being egotistical and I'm just upset because she's not here, because I want her to be here and I want to tell her about all this stuff that's going on in my life. So in that moment, I don't care about her. I don't care about myself. So that's the other turnaround. You turn it around to the self. And so I'm not being very kind to myself in this moment when I'm sitting here believing this thought, imagining these horrible stories about my friend. That's not very nice to me. So when I'm judging someone else, I'm in judgment, I'm in tension, I'm in stress, I'm not happy. So I don't care about me in that moment.
Love that.
So it's kind of a yoga practice for the mind.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Open the mind, to stretch the mind. And then once you've done the turnaround, you just let it be And then you might, I mean, the way I do it now, I might sit and feel, okay, now I'm ready to text my friend. Hey, sweetie, are you okay? I thought we had a 1 o'clock. I love you. Hope you're doing good. And, you know, I can create a very different experience in my life from that place.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I have two questions on this. And I love how you share that. It's such a powerful method when you've tried it. It is absolutely amazing. I wish I would have known about it at the beginning of my marriage.
Yeah.
I guess I definitely got a lot more peaceful when I started to question my thoughts. Because initially in our marriage, you know, I would be triggered and I would have texted and it would not have been from a very good, well, actually, we didn't text each other in those days, but I would have said something that would have been from that blaming, judging energy. And then as I learned to question my thoughts, it was much easier for me to stop and then be able to move into genuine compassion and care. And that was the power of it. It was amazing to discover that, you know, I'm not my thoughts. Don't believe what I think. There are just thoughts. It was such a hallelujah moment. And I went, oh my God, I'm not my thoughts. How wonderful is that? And then the next question on that is that I certainly went too much into the whole concept of being loving and being compassionate at times when what I needed to do was to roar and put down a boundary. And so with that, when I was then questioning my thoughts and turning them around to me, I could get kind of trapped in that because I would always feel, well, it's my projection and it's just my perception. So if I just work on changing me, then this will change. And obviously I then had an agenda because I was hoping that this would change. And it took me ages to figure out, no, what changes is that I now need to disengage from that, but still with compassion, but also compassion for me.
Mm-hmm.
If that makes sense. So can you share some light on this? Because this is a fairly common dilemma, I think.
Yeah. Well, a lot in the past, before I started questioning my thoughts, I would definitely act loving and compassionate and light-filled in situations where I actually wasn't. So it wasn't real, wasn't authentic. With this method, I feel like it just brings me home to myself so much. So there's just an authenticity there that makes it so easy. But also, so like in this example, you know, if this is the second or third time my friend forgets a lunch date or something, next time we'll do it, set up a date, I will know she may or may not show up. That's her MO. That's how she does it. And I can judge and be upset about that all I want. I can want her to change. But the reality is I can't. Then I might go, well, you know what? You haven't shown up for 3 dates, so I'm not going to make any plans for this person anymore. And that's my boundary. I don't really feel a need to have boundaries anymore in my life because it comes through me, the yes or the no. It just comes through step by step. Yes, that's okay. No, that's not okay. And it's just all love. You know, I hear that you really want this. I mean, especially during the teenage years, you know, when the teenagers get super upset, then they really pressure you into something. And I could just be very calm, very loving. No, you can't borrow my car today. It's not possible.
I love that example. That is such a good example because that is completely with love. There is no boundaries in that. It's just no. You know, it's such a... There's no tension in it. Because boundaries sometimes come also with tension, I think. But certainly if we're not used to creating boundaries, it was like that for me anyway, because I was not good with boundaries for a long, long time. So I then needed to have like an oomph with that. But with as you're sharing, you know, with your kids, regardless of the age they're at, it's much easier. Because you know that the no is from love.
Yeah. And, you know, if I have done a lot of work on myself as a parent and my thoughts about my children, you know, my daughter should respect me. That was a very common occurring thought when she was a teenager. You know, if I've done all that work, I can be there as a calm presence in her life.
How did you work that one around, if you don't mind me asking? Because I think that's a common thought. I had that my daughters should study.
Yeah.
I had that one. So, because I went, you know, I studied. So, you know, and that was, had many aha moments when I had to work on that within myself, when I interfered in their business rather than my own.
Yes. Well, I turned it around. I should be respectful of my daughter.
Mm.
And I should be respectful of the fact that she's a teenager, that she has an immature mind.
Mm.
I should respect the fact that she's still learning what it is to grow up, to become a human, how to interact with other people.
Mm.
If she's not showing me respect, it's because I haven't taught her that. And that's my business. So that was extremely powerful for me to show her respect, even in the moments when she was disrespectful. So supposedly, you know, she would curse at me or be rude or, you know.
She was just a teenager.
Exactly.
Yeah.
She was. And as I wasn't always able to do this. Sometimes I definitely lost it and I would yell and scream. But over time, I consistently showed her respect, taught her how to be respectful, even when people are not. And she's one of the most respectful people I know today. It's very beautiful to watch my 22-year-old daughter and see how respectful she is of people.
Yeah, that is so beautiful. That is so beautiful.
And the other turnaround, my daughter should not respect me. Well, she can't in this moment. She's upset. She's got hormones raging through her body. All she can think about is that she wants to get to the party, to get to the hot guy that she's been talking to on whatever, you know, WhatsApp or whatever. She's not capable of respecting her mother in this moment. So that's why she shouldn't.
Yeah. I know when it comes to the teenage part as well, it was really helpful for me to recognize that their brain is still developing. So, you know, we have to be compassionate with that. And that really helped me to remind myself many times. It's, you know, they're developing. And then when I look back on how I was when I was a teenager, absolutely. Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, thank you. And that is something I did a lot when she was the teenager. Where was I at when I was 13, 14, 15, 16, 17? I basically hated my parents. I was very disrespectful towards them. So, you know, my teenage daughter should be an adult already. Well, that's not possible. That's like saying, well, it shouldn't rain when it's raining, you know?
I know also when they were going through their teenage stage, my daughters, what was really, really painful and brutal for me was so liberating as I was working my way through it, was to see where my mind would get in the way, where my ego would get in the way, where I had all these expectations, and also how I had an expectation because I got so used to it when they were growing up that, you know, they absolutely adored me. They loved me. I was the best thing ever. And then suddenly they look at you as if you're something, you know, the cat has dragged in and they just look at you with horror. It's that crushing of your ego self where I had this story, as you say, I'm a great mom. And suddenly I'm not a great mom. This is just collapsing in front of my eyes here. And it was so freeing to start to look at that. Yeah. It took me a while, though, to figure it out. Initially, I just thought I was right.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
It's also such a beautiful practice in keeping my heart open, because I claim that I love my children, right? And then they start getting older and they start misbehaving and they're not so, they don't have such a high opinion of me anymore. It's like, I mean, really, the teenagers are the ultimate gurus.
Oh, yes.
Because they see right through you and they know which button to push, which button is going to hurt mom's feelings, you know. So the work really helped me during the teenage years. Oh, my God. We could have a whole podcast about that. But
but it is important, I feel, to recognize what a powerful tool it is to be able to go in and question, are my thoughts real?
Mm-hmm.
Is what I believe, is that really the truth? Or could it mm-hmm. be other layers here?
Mm-hmm.
So that we can have more choices available to us for how we can witness what is happening.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So another thing that Katie says, which I love, is the three businesses. Would you mind sharing that? Because I think it's so spot on.
Sure. She says there are three kinds of business: mine, yours, and God's. So whose business is it how your teenager is acting? We are trained to believe that it's our business as a parent. And what I really came to see is that it's my daughter's business. How I respond and how I am with my daughter, that is my business.
Hmm.
And whose business is it that my son overdosed at 21? Well, that would be God's business.
Yeah. I remember when I think I read it the first time, and I could feel how liberating again it was for me to start to recognize, where am I? Am I in someone else's business, or in my own, or in God's business? And the suffering that comes from when we put our attention in someone else's business and how it drains us. Because we can't do anything anyway. It's just so frustrating. There's no way you can go in there and control it without creating suffering for yourself and others at times.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, when I'm mentally living my life in someone else's life, you know, my mom should eat healthier. My daughter shouldn't stay out so late. My husband should get off his phone and be kinder to me. I mean, like, it's just constant, you know, like a radio channel constantly going. We are so conditioned to be in other people's business. And we think if we're not, it means that we don't care.
Mm.
But what I found was it's actually the ultimate ego trip. Because the reason I want my mom to eat healthier is so that she will be healthier and stay alive longer so that I can be happy. The reason I want my daughter to behave different is because I want to feel loved and seen and respected by my daughter. And so it's all for me. And, you know, it might take a little work before you see this, but I came to realize this so-called caring, which was actually playing God and meddling in other people's business. A, it never did anything good for anybody else. I mean, you can tell somebody, you know, 100 times, you should stop smoking. It's not good for you. And they'll still be smoking until they are ready to stop smoking.
It's the same spin doctor, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
So it just then spins what other people should be doing. But it's also turning on you, interfering with what is really your business as a being, where it then goes in and tells you off and will judge you and criticize you. That it's kind of insane, that aspect
Yeah. And I also, like you were saying, I'm draining myself of energy.
Yeah.
I am not fully present with myself and my true authentic self and my true nature of love. So I'm actually not being very loving towards that person.
Mm. Yeah.
And so something that I found was to ask, how can I help? How can I be of support? Can I be of any support to you right now? No, stay the fuck away from me. Slam. Like, okay, well, that was very clear directions. I can support you by staying away, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. So by asking that question, how can I help? You allow that space for that. Because I think worry is something that many of us do, thinking that, again, we're being loving because we're being mm-hmm. caring. But it's not. It's imposing.
Yeah. And it doesn't really do anything either. I mean, you know, we can be worrying all day long, and the worrying will actually keep me from maybe taking some actions that I could take to help someone or support someone, or, you know, maybe I need to read a few more books about how to raise teenagers so I can support myself more, you know, instead of constantly being in her business.
Mm. Mm. Exactly. So is there anything else you would like to add?
Well, I think one of the most profound areas where I have used to work after my son's passing is the thoughts about myself, my own inner self-critic, which was very strong. I had parents that were very judgmental and who would share their judgments with me about me. I think back in those days, I think maybe my dad thought it would spur me on to do better, but it had the opposite effect. It made me feel unloved and small. And so I had very low self-esteem. I had a very harsh inner critic. And it got a little bit better through meditation, through certain spiritual practices, but it was still very much active after I started doing the work. So I began to write down my self-critical thoughts and I began questioning them. And that was so very powerful. I'm not good enough. There's something wrong with me. That was my personal favorite. And because there's something wrong with me, I have always done something wrong. Everything was always my fault, you know. I don't deserve love. I was a mistake. I shouldn't have been born. And as I've been working with people now for 20 years, these self-critical thoughts are so common. I mean, talk about a global pandemic. Mm. We all suffer from this to some degree. Slightly different stories, slightly different versions, but basically, I'm not good enough and there's something wrong with me. I should be different. I should be more blah, 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 you know, loving, compassionate. I should be more successful. I should have more followers on social media, all of those things. And then we build an identity from these self-critical, self-limiting thoughts, beliefs that we attached to when we were maybe 5, 6 years old. And so we build an identity from that, that we then live our life from. And it was very powerful for me to go back and do the work with my own inner child. Mm. Do the work with that little girl. Is it true that there's something wrong with you? So the work can travel in time. You can go to the future, something you're scared of in the future, and do the work. You can go back in time. So I would do that. I would go back to all the painful memories I had from my childhood. They were like these bubbles of memories. And I would go in there and try my best to connect with that little girl and ask her the four questions. Is it true? You know, and how do you feel when you believe there's something wrong with you? Well, I feel very guilty and ashamed, and I think my parents don't love me. And so that work also took me a couple of years, and it was so tender, and it would come in my original language, Swedish, but that completely changed my inner voice and my relationship to myself. And I thought at first when I started out that, you know, low self-esteem, the opposite of low self-esteem is high self-esteem, right? I'm the best. I can do it. Oh, yeah. You know, I'm super successful. I'm going to make $1 million. But what I found was very different. I found just a humility and a place where I'm much less attached to this persona called Helena.
Yeah.
So now I'm living my life. It's more like I'm witnessing, like, oh, okay, she's doing this today. Oh, okay, she's planning a class apparently. All right, okay, let's plan this class. Blah blah blah. And I'm not constantly watching myself from that inner critic place.
Yeah.
Watching for what is she going to do wrong, you know?
Yeah.
And so that became one of my favorite places to share the work with people. And I turned it into a 6-month program. So
I was just wondering, would you mind, because it keeps popping into my head now, would you mind maybe doing a demo on that with me so that people can witness that process? Because I think we can all feel, yeah, I got that, you know, that inner child that we can all feel got wounded at times. Would that be okay?
Yeah, totally.
A bit scary for me, but we'll do it. So it's good.
Okay. Well, do you have a self-critical thought that comes up for you, or one that was very common for you when you were a little girl?
That I'm wrong. I'm bad. It's something wrong with me. I am bad as I am.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I was the black sheep.
Ah.
Mm.
Me too.
And the scapegoat. So my dad was a severe alcoholic, and he was brain damaged before I was born. So there was a lot of volatility, and I'm the eldest. I'm very much like him. And yeah, I was in the firing line of that.
Mm-hmm.
And then my youngest sister, she was the favorite, so I was wrong. And I can see now, you know, she was little and cute. So it's like you see with dogs, you know, the little puppy, really cute. But I, yeah.
Okay. Well, so do you have a memory, like a specific moment in time where you experienced this?
Yeah, I do, actually. I'm being brought back to a memory. And I am sitting drawing. And we've finished eating. I'm sitting there drawing. And I'm really happy sitting there drawing. And my sister is helping my mom to clear the table. My dad gets really angry that I'm being lazy, sitting there drawing. And he says, you know, he actually said, you're not feminine like your sister. And I was about maybe 6. And I formed a belief that I've actually carried that belief with me for a long time after that. I'm not feminine. I'm not, did something wrong with me in this. Yeah. Yeah. That one is the one that springs to mind.
And about how old were you then?
I would have been about 6, maybe.
All right. You said that. Okay. So 6-year-old Sissy, you are sitting there at the table, you are drawing, you're happy to be drawing.
I'm sitting on the floor actually drawing. Yeah.
Okay.
I'm very happy. I'm being creative. I'm in my own world. I'm being very happy sitting there. Yeah.
And then your dad says, you're not feminine like your sister.
Yeah. And he also makes me wrong for not helping.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yes. So you're bad.
Yeah.
Is that true?
Mm. my logical mind knows it's not true, but that child, she doesn't know that. She does feel it's something wrong with her. It's like, why can't he love me that way?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that would be a yes.
Oh.
Yes, it feels true that I'm bad.
And I can see how that spun into that I always have to do things for other people. It wasn't mm-hmm. okay for me to just sit there and draw.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so, Sissy, 6 years old, are you sure? Are you really sure that this is true, that you are bad?
No. No, I'm not really sure about that.
There, good to know this. Yeah.
Yeah, there is like an opening in me. It feels like in my heart where it feels like I'm okay doing this. But it's still a heavy weight of
okay.
Of what I feel is judgment coming towards me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so how did you react? How did you feel when you believed this idea that you're bad?
I closed down. I closed down. I just disengage. I retreat even more into my own world because it feels safer there.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I did that. I retreated actually into my own world and then I just ran. By the time I was 18, I was out of there. So I can see that that was that. It was like a retreat. You know, you're on a battlefield and you go into retreat instead. Mm-hmm. Not like that with my armor around me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
How did you see your dad when you were believing this, that you are bad?
That's more hazy. I felt more sad that he couldn't see me, but I can't see him either now, I realize. It's hazy. I think mm-hmm. I've been protecting myself from seeing him. Again, with my logical mind, I've later worked through it and I can see he was obviously traumatized and wounded and all of that. And he was just frustrated. And, you know, mm-hmm. I can see that later, but from that child perspective, it's like he's hazy.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to see.
Okay.
Yeah, it's a protection again.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, Cece's 6 years old, sitting on the floor drawing. Your dad says, yeah, you're not feminine like your sister.
Mm.
What could be different if you didn't believe that you were bad in that moment? What do you think could have been different?
I could have just giggled. And kind of, it's like, as I can see now, I mean, in a way I'm seeing it with my adult eyes, but why is it a woman's job to clear the table? It's like, why couldn't he help to clear the table instead of making it into a judgment on me?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And so go back to that six-year-old and just see, like, what could have been different for her in that moment if she didn't believe that she was bad?
I can just feel my heart opening. So I just feel my heart opening. I actually don't get any thoughts as such, but I feel my heart opening. And I see her, I feel her. She's making a drawing that she gives to him.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So it's like she's still offering. She's just sharing. She's just sharing from her love and creativity. Still, without that thought that she's bad, she just keeps on sharing. Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah, I can feel my heart just keeps opening with that. So she's not rushing to do what he wants her to do. And she's not judging him. She's just doing what she's doing. She's just mm-hmm. being creative.
Mm-hmm.
She's staying in that magical space of just being authentic in what she's doing. In that moment. Wow. Yeah.
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 She's staying in her own business.
Yes. She's just mm-hmm. keep on being happy in that. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. If we turn it around, I am good. So now see if 6-year-old Sissy can find an example or two of how is that true that she's good.
She's good. She's a 6-year-old girl. It's inherently in her nature. She's good. And she's also just being herself. She's just enjoying the moment, actually.
Mm-hmm.
She's just being present in that. There's a goodness in that presence. Yeah.
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 And another way of saying this is that, or turning this around, my thoughts about myself are bad.
Mm.
What I'm thinking about myself is bad.
But I can see now, it wasn't even her thoughts. It wasn't her thoughts initially. It was like this energy, these webs being spun around her from, you know, my dad or whatever. And then she believed that.
Exactly. True.
But it wasn't even hers to start with. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, my
dad had nothing to do with her. It had absolutely nothing to do with her.
Mm-mm.
That was his spin doctor. That was his web. His thoughts had nothing to do with her. Yeah.
My dad said, "You're not feminine." And who believed it?
That would
be me, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
My dad would say, "Yeah, you're just not normal." And so he said that. And who believed it? That was me.
Yeah.
So, yeah, we create an identity from early on, from whatever thoughts we you know, attach to and take in from our parents, our culture. So this was just kind of very quick since we're on a call here, but I certainly did this. I read a lot of spiritual books and I also learned to use my adult logic like you were doing. I mean, I understand as an adult that my father was an alcoholic and all of these things. And that's good. That can help us a little bit. But what I found was when I went back to that little girl and kind of brought her back home, you know, she was kind of left there in that scenario and help her to see that, no, you know what? I'm not bad.
Mm. Yeah. And I can really feel it in my body. Yeah, I could feel it in my body. The heart just opening. So all that armor was left. Yeah. Beautiful. Mm-hmm. Thank you. That was so quick as well. Thank you. Perfect. Beautiful. So this is what you teach in your, is it the 6-month program?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yes. So it's a deep going program. So we do go back like we did now to, you know, find that little boy or girl and see what I was thinking and believing then, or what thoughts I took on, or how I interpreted situations. You know, my father hits me. Well, that must mean I'm bad, right? Because otherwise he wouldn't do that. So yes, it's very beautiful, very deep work.
It feels as if when you took me through it now, it's like, just like the title actually of one of your courses, that's inquiry to come back to your true self. It's like she was there in her true self, just drawing, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and actually I call the program Uncover Your True Self, because yeah. That's what I came to. You know, I used all these meditations and all this stuff to find my authentic self. And, you know, I mean, it was all beautiful and helpful. And this work, when I could start to dissolve these old critical limiting beliefs about myself, there it was. No effort needed. I don't need to try to improve myself. That true self is already there. It's just had a lot of layers on top of it. And, you know, so we walk into the world with that identity. There's something wrong with me. You know, I'm bad. And we come up with coping mechanisms to not feel that. Maybe I'm a people pleaser. You know, maybe I always try to smile, even if I don't mean it, because I need people to like me. And for me, it would show up in public speaking. I mean, like, if this would have been years ago, I would have had diarrhea for days that I was going to be on this interview with you.
Wow.
Because I was so petrified of speaking in front of people, because I felt like they would see through me. They would realize there's something wrong with me and I'm just a fake, you know? And after having done this work, now it's just like a beautiful sharing. I'm just grateful to be here and it's, you know, fun.
Beautiful, beautiful. Thank you. I'm so glad that you are sharing it with so many of us, because it is such a beautiful medicine held in it. I still feel this opening in my heart. So thank you, Helena, for sharing all of this with us today. It's been amazing.
Thank you, sweetie.
For more information about Helena and her work, such as her latest offerings and courses, visit lookwithininstitute.com. Thank you so much for listening, everyone. Bye-bye.